touching the ground, I connect with all of life. Touching my heart, I awaken compassion for all life. You are listening to Anamkara, A Friend on the Journey, a podcast about life, the variety of lived spiritualities of the people around us, and how we are much more alike than different. I am your host, Brother Pax. Albert Einstein is quoted as saying, "I live in that solitude which is painful in youth, but delicious in years of maturity." A couple of weeks ago, I had a dream where I was traveling with a holy man, a saint, somewhere in the Middle East or India, serving the poor. This saint was known performing miracles and caring for the outcast. And while I sat with him, I came to a strange realization that we would never be together. And he laughed and said, "No, we won't." And then suddenly a family came running up to me and told me that one of their family members was dying and please come. They were expecting me to do some type of work, some type of miracle, some type of something. And I look to the saint and he's gone, and I realize that I had merged with this figure and that I was the saint. Strange dream. And I don't claim to be any type of saint in waking or sleeping life, but that dream spoke something to me. It whispered to me that somewhere along the line, I had lost my spiritual vision. Somewhere, I had lost my mission. And so I did what I needed. Just recently, I took a retreat. I stayed at the St. Francis of the Woods in Coyle, Oklahoma, for a silent retreat. And in that time, I meditated, prayed, communed with nature, read and journaled a lot. And during that retreat, I found that still small voice in my center once again. And I came out of that retreat feeling like I had a better idea of where to go, where I needed, how to maybe move a little more fully into that divine life that I'm called and that which we're all called. Well, my guest today has also heard that still small voice, and it's led him to become a monk. Mark Gladman, also known as Brother Frederick James, also has the nickname of Monk and Dox due to his wearing of Doc Martens. So let's dive right in and hear more about the life of a monk. Do you prefer Brother Frederick, Brother?
Whatever, Mark Swan. It really doesn't matter. To my community, I'm Brother Frederick James. To most of the rest of the world, I'm still Mark. Just don't call me late for breakfast.
That's right. So my guest today has also heard that still small voice, and it's led him to become a monk. Mark Gladman, also known as Brother Frederick James, is known as the Monk in Docs due to your wearing of Doc Martens. Is that correct?
Well, when I'm in my habit, yes. The rest of the time, usually I'm barefoot or in very minimalist shoes. So I guess like the way I live as a monk, the shoes are a bit of an anomaly. But certainly when the habit's on, I have Docs on. Yes, that's right.
Right. Well, thank you for being here today. So let's dive right in. So just start with something fun. What's been on your mind lately?
On my mind, wow. Well, just this morning, I was finishing writing up the second study in one of the series that's on my website, The Table. And in that, I was talking about that the name of the study is Immerse. The study is like 12, it's a series of 12 studies in words that start with IMM. So we're looking at what it means to be immersed in God. And I literally, about half an hour before getting on the call with you, had just finished writing up a section where I was using Thomas Merton, Alfred Lord Tennyson, Augustine, and Alan Watts to describe.
Just some lightweights, right?
just the lightweights. And I mean, you can't get a more varied, broad hit from those. But all of these people shared some things that look at what it means to live and understand that we live in a world that is immersed in God and a God who is immersed in us. And so, yeah, that's literally what has been on my mind for the, I was working on some of that yesterday as well, and spending some time on it this morning, just getting the final touches done before I record the audio. So that's literally quoting Alan Watts talking about union with God is reality, and reality is union with God. And that's all there is to it.
We could go so deep in that. Definitely, I just got back from a retreat, and that's some of the stuff I've been thinking on. It's like, what does that mean? What does that truly mean? How is that right. experience? How is that lived?
Yeah.
It's like, I get the intellectual piece to some degree, but how does that play into daily life? Yeah.
Well, even intellectually, it's a really difficult thing to comprehend. I mean, one of the examples that I use from Watts, again, is he compares understanding the reality that God is with understanding the reality that now is all we have. And he compares God to being the now. That
oh, I love it.
This very moment holds us in all that it is. This is all we've got, it's all we have, and it's all we are. We don't have the second that's just gone or the second that's to come. And he says, union with God, it is that. That is their analogy, that there is nothing else. All we have is that. Of course, this, for some people, depending on what tradition they might come from, and I would say particularly for many Christians, this would be a struggle because they've grown up predominantly with an anthropomorphic understanding and view of God and who God and what God is, whereas more of a Taoist or even Buddhist take on who and what, although Taoists wouldn't call it God, they would call it Tao or reality or the way. That's a lot easier a concept to understand from that Eastern approach. So, you know, it is still quite the, you know, even grappling it from an intellectual perspective and getting your head around it, then actually living into the reality of it is, I think, a difficult concept for a lot of people to pick up. Wow, we've started light, haven't we?
Well, yeah, we sure have. That's great, though. You know, I miss sometimes conversations like these. You know, people just want to go deep and discuss these things. I keep wanting to create a group here called the Dead Theologian Society and just talk about all these different things coming together. So this
yeah.
is great. But I am going to go a little lighter for the viewers, and then we can actually circle back around if we have time. So one of my first questions is, obviously, you're a monk. What is a monk?
Wow. Okay. So it's first of all probably important that I state that I'm not a monk in the traditional sense that people would understand Christian monasticism. I am still a very legitimate monk, and I'll explain how that works. But a lot of people think of monks as these cloistered people who have literally given themselves to their religious life 100%. They've shrugged off everything else and have just gone and lived together with all these other people in this community, which is often called a monastery or a mother house, and that's where they're living out their faith in various ways. Some monks aren't completely cloistered, they're partially cloistered. In other words, they do interact with those outside of the community. Some monastic communities are well known for doing everything but. I mean, some monastic communities run schools and universities. Some monastic communities have breweries and all sorts of stuff going on. But there are other monastic communities who would be completely cloistered, and probably the Carthusians would be one of the most famous, who literally go off and live in their charter houses and shut themselves off, not just from the rest of the world, but for a lot of the time they're in there from each other. They'll come together to pray a couple of the offices in the day. The rest of the time they'll do their prayer in their own room, their own sort of a mini apartment. They'll have a garden off their mini apartment. Food gets delivered to them. They'll work around the monastery, but they'll do it in complete silence. So that's a more of a traditional view of a monk. I am a Benedictine monk, so my community holds to the rule of St. Benedict. And our community was founded by a traditional monk, Abbot Michael John, who is still our abbot today. And he's been involved in, this is the second community he started under the same sort of ideal. He took two canons. So it's probably important I also mention that our community is not connected to the Catholic Church, but is connected to the Episcopal Church in the United States. And for those of us who are outside the States, it's obviously then connected to what we would call the Anglican Communion, or in England, the Church of England, or what have you, which is different to the Anglican Church of North America. That's probably important to point out. So the Episcopal Church is the one that we are connected to, both technically Anglican or from the CoE, but politics, you know, what happens there. We won't worry about that. But our abbot took two canons of the Episcopal Church. One was a canon that was had to do with religious communities. One was a canon that had to do with religious orders. And he meshed the two together. He did that because as he read the rule of St. Benedict, he started to realize that in the modern world, what would Benedict have envisaged as a way of living out the rule and one's life and faith in God in the modern world? Remembering that in Benedict's time, we're talking the 6th century, there was, you know, not ways to travel long distances, not ways to communicate over long distances. And so you have this very traditional form of monasticism where people come to a place and stay. One of the vows of a Benedictine is stability. And so they vow to stay in that place with those people until they die, basically. And so our abbot started to dream and envision what this would look like and created a constitution and a customary which embraced the possibility of a different way of living out fully vowed religious life in a slightly different context. Now, there are some things within the rule of St. Benedict that means that there was some stuff that had to be a given. One of those was to have a mother house or a community center. But within the context of the rule, and as has been demonstrated at various points throughout history, monks haven't always necessarily been restricted to that place. As we talked about before, monks are very much involved in different work in different parts of the world, often away from their mother house. So what we are is a community of male and female monks, and some of the females would still call themselves monks, but others would call themselves nuns, who are attracted to spirituality from a Benedictine perspective and who have committed themselves to this community till either death or they choose to remove themselves. But what's a little bit different is that while we still have a mother house where we regularly meet, we live out our vocation in our own locations, in our own homes, in our own jobs, in our own contexts. And what that has meant is that for some of us, we are permitted to be married or in vowed relationships. And so that's a little bit of a takeaway from the norm of monasticism, but you can understand the practicalities of living in a monastic community is that to have relationships within that context could take away from the essence of what it means to live out their vocation. But it's interesting, I actually did some study about this as part of a postgraduate degree. And it's interesting that within the context of the rule of St. Benedict, monasticism has been lived out in history, that to permit vowed monks to be in relationships, married relationships, actually doesn't take away, but probably enhances the truth of what it means to live out a monastic vocation. So I'm in Australia. Our mother house is based in Puerto Rico. It was in Houston, then moved to Vermont, and recently was invited to come and set up in Puerto Rico. And we are 1 year there and just about to move into the mother house, which the Diocese of Puerto Rico provided for us. And it's been completely renovated, and we've spent a lot of time and effort to make it a place that it's right on the edge of a very poor community, and the ministry will now be able to be a hospitality to the poor in that part of Ponce, which is fantastic. But that's there. And while our community will go and reconnect there with each other twice a year for what we call our convocation, the rest of the time I live here in Australia, in my own home, in country South Queensland, which is Queensland's our state. And I live out my vocation as a monk. Before I lived here, not long ago, I lived on the Gold Coast, which is a coastal city, where I worked as a chaplain in a school, and lived out my faith and vocation in that setting. So while I still keep all of the regular patterns of life and living that a monk would keep, I do it in my own setting. As far as community goes, we meet regularly via Zoom. So here's where the technology comes into play. Obviously, airplanes enable us to get to the mother house and meet together in person. And then regularly every week we share over Zoom. We come together for prayer. We come together for teaching. The abbot speaks to us at those meetings, and we have what's called a chapter meeting, I suppose. Regularly there'll be meetings of different parts of the community who will come together via that technology. Our abbot also keeps contact with us all, and we keep contact with each other on a daily basis in Slack. We use the platform Slack as a way to communicate regularly with each other and keep each other in touch with what's going on in our lives, to share prayer, to encourage one another, and so on. So we actually very, very closely connected. When we come together, it's not like we have to catch up, because we literally would have spoken to each other the day before. But we know what's going on in each other's lives, and we still share that sense of community and accountability to community. Yes, it's different in the sense that I don't have anyone looking over my shoulder. So there is a huge trust angle that goes on with this, not just the abbot's trust of us continuing to keep to our monastic formation and vocation, but trust also in ourselves, that we're not lying to ourselves and kidding ourselves that what we're doing or what we're not doing, probably more the point, is kosher. So that's, I guess, I hope, a very broad yet also limited in some sense. You might have more questions about that, but that's how I, as a monk, live here in a community that's based 15,000 kilometers away or something like that. And yet we still have that very, very close sense of brother and sisterhood, of collegiality, of formation and vocation together, and of sharing about how our vocation is making a difference where we live.
I was a monk and in a similar type of situation, actually, but it was Hindu. This was pre-Zoom days, but would write my spiritual teacher every single day, and he would write back and report on our practice. And again, could be in a committed relationship, worked like everyone else, but at the same time had practices I did. So I definitely can relate to that. Were you raised a religious child?
Kind of. In Australia at that time, before we became the Anglican Church, we were still called the Church of England in Australia, C of E. Is what you write on the forms, but the joke was that C of E actually meant Christmas and Easter, which kind of explains my church going growing up. It's not that my parents didn't believe in God, it's just that the life that we had, my dad was an army officer, we moved quite often, so it was very hard to make links to community. It also meant that most of our ministry to our family came through the chaplain that was in my dad's unit. So church going kind of wasn't a thing, but when I was 12, being good Anglicans, they took me to be confirmed, just like they'd taken me to be baptized as a child. And something about that experience, learning about faith with a military chaplain, funny enough, who is, I still see as a mentor today, Len Ecott, who became a bishop over time and was my dad's chaplain for a number of occasions. But you know, something about the way he taught us and took us through that confirmation preparation just drilled home for me the seriousness of this idea of God and who God was. And so from that point, after I was confirmed, I kept taking myself to church, even though my family's attendance sort of dwindled off after the confirmation. But what's interesting is that I also at that same time started to go on a spiritual search, I guess in the back of my mind going, well, you know, this is the faith of my parents. What do I want to make my own? I can see that this is serious and there's something that resonates with me about it, but I need to make this my own. So as a 13-year-old, and I look back now, you know, I turned 50 this year. I look back to me as a 13-year-old and think that was actually pretty serious what you did back then. You know, and speaking to as someone who has spent most of their life in some form of formal academic study, I literally over the course of between 13 and 16 or so ripped into the different isms and religions and philosophies of life and living. Some of them resonated, some of them didn't. Some of them were difficult because at that time in Australia it was hard to find a place where if you wanted to engage in it, where would you go to interact with others who are doing that and to learn more about it. So what I came to the conclusion at the end was is that the Christian tradition is the one through which I understand God best. It was the one I was raised in. But an inkling in the back of my head even then that it wasn't the only one. It wasn't until maybe a year or so after that that interestingly enough, in a very evangelical context and a very fundamentalist context, I became a Christian and started attending church regularly once again. And that was the setting that I stayed in then for another, between 10 and 12 years. And so some of those, you know, formative times in ministry and certainly my initial study into theology was in that fundamentalist evangelical setting where the Bible was very literal, where other religions were anathema, where the understanding of God within the context of this evangelical framework is all there is and anything else can't be of God. And for some of that time too, it was in a Pentecostal setting where there was this understanding of spiritual things. But what that did too was, I guess, open up for me an initial toe dip into the mystic side of Christianity. Obviously, it's not the mystic side that I still work within today.
What brought the change from evangelical fundamentalist Christianity to a more contemplative mystical?
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, I was a chaplain in another school at that time, and my lead chaplain came into the office and said, "Are you all right? You look like you're in deep thought." And I turned around. I remember saying to Ian, "I want to be an oak tree, but I feel like a palm." And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, look, as a palm tree, I think the tree's good. It's bearing great fruit, but man, the roots are shallow." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I feel like I'm being really shallow about my faith." And this had come about because a few things had happened that had made me start to question just taking things at face value. That there was a certain shallowness to just taking a literal surface level understanding of things and running with those and saying that that's all there is and that's all the truth that is in it. And I said, "I want to be an oak. You know, not only do I want to have these really strong roots that spread out and stabilize, but I want to have a tap root that goes down nice and deep and holds me into the ground. I don't want to be an oak tree anymore. I don't want to be a palm tree anymore. I want to be an oak." And that's pretty much what started the journey. And I suppose part of that journey was realizing that one of the struggles I had was understanding that whilst I had seen myself, mainly because others had seen me as an extrovert, the reality was I was an introvert. And that simply because of the simply because of the role I took and the job that I did, and I still am today, I'm an extroverted introvert. You know, put me, and this is what I couldn't understand. I would, for a bit of time there, I was, you know, on the speaking circuit and played in some bands and stuff. And I would, you know, go to these conferences where I was speaking in front of, you know, lots of people. And I would feel very, very comfortable standing on a platform speaking to lots of people. But then put me in a room full of those same people in the coffee break, and I'd be wanting to go hide in the corner. And I didn't understand that. It didn't make sense to me until I learned more about what it literally actually means to be an introvert. But what I also learned about that is that there's this way of praying that matches that personality type. That to embrace that would be healthy. And that's where I started to discover the more introverted and more contemplative forms of prayer, which came about because out of that conversation with Ian was the comment from him, well, if it's roots you're looking for, maybe you need to go back to yours. He was he's a very wise man, and I still visit him to this day. I saw him just a couple of months ago. I'm going to need to go back and see him. Lives up the road now. Moving back, he was a bonus. But I took that to mean two ways. I took that to mean the Jesus tradition and the tradition in which I'd been brought up in. So I worked forwards from the Jesus tradition and I worked backwards from the tradition that I'd been brought up in until they sort of met. And interestingly, the following year after asking that question, I found myself in a job within an Anglican / Episcopal context, which gave me a framework to explore those things. I was reintroduced to the prayer book and realized that it wasn't vain repetition as I had been taught in the evangelical church. I had been taught that it was all man-made words or human-made words. And yet when I pulled out the prayer book, all I could see was scripture throughout the entire thing. It's just almost verbatim, right. Scripture. And I was reintroduced to the concept of the daily offices, morning and evening prayer, which then a friend of mine said, you know, that's a Benedictine thing. And I said, what's a Benedictine? Mm-hmm. And so that's where it all began. And that journey started around about 2000, the Benedictine part started in about 2007. So I came out of the evangelical Pentecostal setting in 2002, 2003, began walking in that more liturgical type of Christian faith, where I was introduced a little bit to religious life. We had some Franciscans in the Diocese of Brisbane, in Annerley, and I became good friends with some of those friars. Then 2008, a friend of mine introduced me to St. Benedict, and here we are.
So why Benedictine and not Franciscan?
I guess that is an interesting thought, and I think it's because the Benedictine life is more contemplative than the Franciscan life is. The Franciscan life is more active, not that they're not contemplative people, but they are way more active. Benedictines traditionally, and I guess by appeal, tend to be very contemplative, very bookish, very study-ish, and pretty much that's what I've done almost my whole life, even in schools. When I'm not standing in front of a group of students or a group of students or in a church setting in front of a group of people sharing about faith and facilitating conversations about faith together, I'm studying to curate material to help people move forward and, you know, bringing my own thoughts to the floor with that. So the Benedictine life really does suit who I am, and it's a personality thing. There's a great book, which is an older book, but it's still a fantastic read, called Prayer and Temperament. And if you can find a copy, I really encourage people to do that, because it looks at, and I know this is not perfect, but it looks at the Myers-Briggs personality identifier and compares those with different types of prayer.
Really?
And prayer life, which is fantastic, because if you're an extrovert, there is a prayer, way of prayer within the Christian tradition that's very extroverted. For those of us who are more introverted, there are some of those. And so it's a really fascinating look at understanding how God's made us and realizing right. that there is a breadth of Christian tradition and worship and understanding out there, probably because we all come at it from the way God has made us. So I certainly don't sit here and say everyone needs to be Benedictine and do Lectio Divina and pray the daily office and sit in silence for a lot of time and meditate, half an hour a day or whatever. But if you're introverted, I can tell you some of the things might really suit you well.
Right.
And you might really enjoy them.
I just added that to my book list right now. I'm like, okay,
it's required reading for all novices that come into our community, because we want them to understand who they are and to be sure that Benedictine life is a way of life that will suit who they are. And if it's not, that's okay. And we'll do what we can to help you find other opportunities that you think might more fit your lifestyle and your personality type. Absolutely.
Now, you are married, correct?
Yes, I am.
I'm curious, what does your spouse think of it?
Paula and I met while I was already a monk. It sort of came with the territory for her. And once she sort of got her head around it, she understood it. But obviously, if you're going to live this life, you kind of need a partner who not only understands, but is going to be supportive. Mm-hmm. And so she's very beautiful in the way that, I'm up at 4 a.m. Part of it's me, part of it's doing things that prepare me for my day from my vocation. Mm-hmm. She is very happy to give time and space for me to do that. I guess the bonus is that we're both out of previous marriages. So both of our children, I have two, Paula has one, they've all grown up. So it's not like we're also juggling the sharing, the growing up with the kids or anything, or the caring of the children or anything like that in that sense, unless you count the dogs. But, Paula, she has her own way of doing and being in her faith, and some of those things work because what I do works for her. Others aren't, but we give each other permission to simply be who we are. And I think that's I would hope the ground framework for any marriage. That you give yourself permission to both fully be who you are, and you love each other for being fully who you are, and you give each other the space to do those things. What's interesting too is that in our community, our abbot insists that every member regularly fill out and update what he calls the day planner. And that is a weekly schedule where it's not to say, I schedule my wife into this time. I really don't believe in that. I think if you've committed yourself to a relationship with your wife, then that's a part of who you are, and you make the time for that regardless. But what the abbot wants to see is that outside the scope of the things that we have in our daily life, so for us, we would have, we're committed to a prayer office 4 times a day, that we have daily time in Lectio Divina, which is a contemplative form of prayer that involves reading scripture. And that we would have time of prayer outside of that. Then obviously there's things that we do as part of our formation, ongoing formation and vocation. Some study that we do for the abbot, which we contribute every 3 months, once a quarter. We report to our abbot on some things in our lives and so on. And obviously there's regular conversations, discussions, commitment to our regular meetings online and so on. But, outside of that, we have a lot of flexibility to live out our vocation as we see will work for us in our setting. And part of that for me is time with my wife, talking about faith and hearing her perspective on things. So you know, she knew what she was getting into, I suppose you could say,
right.
When we got married. But I would say too that it's not just a case of that, it's a case of coming to marriage in a particular way that gives ourselves the time and the scope to do and be those things together.
Right. So where do you wear your robes and where do you not wear your robes?
Right. Well, again, within our customary, on the habit, our abbot says that the abbot is an outward sign of what's going on within us, not necessarily to show everybody else, but for ourselves. And I think that's a really important distinction. When I do wear the habit, it's not to make an impression on anybody else.
Right.
I wear it as a reminder of who and what I am. There are other ways that I do this too. Even simply down to sometimes if I go out, I'll just throw a little cross in my pocket to remind myself of those things. But quite often, you know, when I was in the school, I wore the habits of more formal ceremonies and services. I would often just wear it to services on an occasional basis. There were times in the school I'd get around in it. And in fact, I had a couple of people, students and teachers, who would say to me, "I love it when you wear the habit." It was unusual. While the school was connected to the Anglican Church, Episcopal Church, it didn't necessarily have a religious community connected to it. I came into it. But, you know, in that setting, they really felt encouraged by it. There are occasional times when I'll put it on at home, just to, again, as a reminder of who and what I am. There are obviously practical things to consider with that. If I'm out doing the gardening, you know, in a traditional setting, the monks literally have habits that are put aside to wear when you're doing the gardening. Down to the fact that often it's a completely different one or a particular type of outfit, or they'll change into regular clothes. They'll take the habit off to go and do the gardening. But there are times when I'll wear it around the home, again, as a reminder of who and what I am. In some ways, you know, you might talk about the mother house or the cloister as being the space in which the monk outworks their vocation. I suppose for us who are living on mission in the world, as our abbot likes to call it, I'm just looking over at my habit as I say this, but our habit is kind of that cloister, but a portable version. And certainly when we're at home at the mother house and in the community around the mother house, we would wear it there.
Yeah.
But it's about, I guess, being sensitive to where you are. In some places it wouldn't be right to wear the habit because, you know, for some places it could be triggering for some people. And I guess it's being mindful of those things as well, and caring for others and doing it out of love if you're doing it at all.
Right. So, brother, I know you can be found on social media, and you actually just launched something new. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, in moving out here to the country and leaving the school, I came to a place where I kind of had nothing to do. So, in that last 6 months, we moved out here mid last year, mid 2022. And I finished the year off. Our school year goes January to December. So I finished the year off at the school till the end of the year, the school year, and then came out here full time. And in that time, of course, Paula and I had many conversations about what I would do. And one of the things that I had been asked to do for some time was to create some resources that would help people grow. So I've been posting on Instagram for many years, but very regularly on a daily basis, just about for the last close to three years now. And out of those daily posts, a daily reflection, I've had a lot of people say, could you create something that teaches us more about this? So my posts are generally about a couple of things. One is they often look at a piece of scripture and look at it a little bit deeply. my posts are often sometimes about seeing God, Jesus, Spirit, Scripture, and yourself in new and different ways, much deeper ways than perhaps there is on a surface. And that seems to have attracted a lot of people who have had a crisis of faith and as a result have deconstructed or are in the process of reconstructing their faith, or who want to hold on to their Christianity, but they want to understand things in a new and different way that they can't seem to get through their life in churches where they are. So a lot of people have been saying, can you write something, create something that will do that? And so that's how the table came about, which you'll find at monkindocs.podia.com, or I think monkindocs.com by itself works as well now. There were some issues with it before. And what you'll find on that website is a whole bunch of resources that will help people do that. There's resources on how to do particular or to trial and practice certain spiritual disciplines. There are resources about how to read scripture. There are resources that are simply a course. There's one called Deeper, which is a course on simply going deeper into our thinking about who we are as people who are trying to have this spiritual experience in the world and what that actually means and looks like. That's what I was working on this morning that I was talking to you about at the start of the podcast. And there are, you know, I have two podcasts, both of which go up there, articles which I'm collating from things that I've written before, which will be up there, studies. I create these Lectio Divina contemplative audios. So they are guided meditations, if you like, that guide people through a Lectio Divina reading.
I've listened to them on my Insight Timer.
Okay. So yeah. All this material is up there on the table, and people can access it. A lot of it is free. Some of it does have a little bit of a cost attached, only because you need to try, and you know, it's not the stuff, the information you're paying for, it's the being able to disseminate it in a way that can most people can access it. But most people will be able to get most of the things that they want absolutely free, because my heart is that everybody's welcome at the table. And have this group of people who have started coming around. That's only been out there 3 weeks, but already there's a group of people who are helping to financially support that work, so that more and more people can access it, access what they need without any hindrance whatsoever. So that's been a real joy and a blessing to create, because my heart is to help people. My heart is to see people thrive in their spiritual life, whether they're Christians or otherwise. Or whether they're Christians but are looking at what other traditions might hold true for them. I want to create resources that will help people do that. A lot of people feel uncomfortable doing it because they don't feel safe doing it, because they've been told it's not safe. A lot of people are uncomfortable doing it because they just don't know where to start. And so to create things that will help people do that exploration. The way I work is not telling people what to think, it's teaching people how to think, so that they can think for themselves. And hopefully they can learn to trust that Spirit will guide them to truth where truth is. And they'll be able to embrace that into their lives and find their lives become more and more beautiful as a result.
Right. Well, brother, thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast today. It's been
a pleasure.
Thanks
so much, Pax. Yeah, cheers. And look forward to catching you some other time.
Absolutely. This has been another episode of Anamkara, A Friend on the Journey. Thank you for walking with me as we spent time exploring the varieties of religious and spiritual expressions out there. Won't you consider joining our Patreon? Get sneak peeks of what is to come, early previews, and soon to have some video footage from the interviews, as well as polls on what you would like to see covered in future episodes. Join our Patreon today. The link is in the show notes. Thank you.